It's Friday, it's a holiday weekend, and this is episode 20 of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted, where my son and partner, Jeremy Zogby, and I, John Zogby, just take a look at the news of the week, do it informally, have some fun, and look forward to the especially nice responses that we get from folks that are listening. And so, Jer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. And I am not getting tired of being, we're not quarantined, but we're home. And I'm kind of liking being at home.
Well, the weather's great and it lends itself to going outside and getting on the porch. So that's always a great thing. And just in time for Memorial weekend. So why don't we get into it? I know you've got an election update and we can talk about that in the second segment of our show. But today we can announce that we are going to be fielding our poll that is going to look at the future of America on some incredibly hot button issues that will go on to define which direction this nation will ultimately go amidst the pandemic that is COVID-19. So I thought it would be fitting that we revisit some of our earlier topics. And when we, you know, weeks ago, were anticipating what the future would look like. And here we are several weeks later, and every week changes. Every week we get a little bit better of an understanding of where we're headed. And so a great conversation could be the boomers' perspective and the millennials' perspective. And so I guess I'd just start out broadly. What's on your mind with the future from your vantage point?
Well, we've changed already. We changed forever and we changed quickly. And I think that that's a very important message, whether it's been imposed by leaders or internalized by us as individuals. We have been presented with, really, in our lifetimes, an unprecedented catastrophe and recognition that something had to be done. We needed to mobilize. Our behavior had to change dramatically. And we did it. There are naysayers. There are people who deny the science. There are people who are fed up. There are people who are actually hurt. And, you know, here we are, over 38 million people now who have immediately, in just the last 6 weeks, lost their jobs. And millions of those are never going to go back to those jobs. But the fact of the matter is, we had to do something because we couldn't do nothing, and we did it. And so now what happens into the future? Do we go back the way we've been? I doubt it. Do we go back with some minor modifications? I doubt that too. Or do we really change? And I think we will. And I think boomers are prepared to do that. I think especially because, to be facetious, so much of our lives have been about us anyway. And in many ways, a lot of the message that came out of this coronavirus was, hey, if you're 70 or older, or then 60 or older, and that essentially is us, then you have been the target population. And so I think we responded to our catastrophe, still are. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's hard to just give the millennial perspective, right? Because I believe demographically speaking, we have outnumbered the boomers. I mean, what are we at? About 80 million or 80 million plus millennials?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
So to say what the millennial perspective is I guess, complicated with that large of a cohort. I would guess, I would imagine that probably within every age group or every generation, there's a split to some degree. We'll find out, you know, when we have the results of our poll, which have you know, larger splits, or you know, have groups that within those generations that go more one way than the other. But I guess I just can't help but notice that, you know, there's such a glaring difference in some of the approaches. I mean, most of the world, it tends to be following the path that, let's say, China started, and then Italy continued, and then the United States persisted with. But what I find fascinating are that there are a few nations that stand out. I mean, really, in any case that you have in life or in the world, there is always going to be variation, right? It's going to be very difficult to have just one way to do things. And I mean, those that stand out, and by, you know, no means is there a connecting of the dots or a continuity or a similarity in this pattern of countries. They're about as different as you can possibly get. But South Korea, Sweden, and Belarus. South Korea is interesting because they've dealt with this. I mean, I lived in South Korea for a half a year. It was really during, it was either avian flu or bird flu back in late 2009. And, you know, the culture there, like also in Japan, are really, you know, terrified of what, you know, they call impanza, influenza, the flu. And children often wear masks and people often wear masks. But Korea's lived with this. And so they didn't react with fear, like I would argue a lot of other nations did. And because they've been down this road, they understood, well, at the same time, you know, you can cripple the nation economically. And so, you know, they didn't take exactly, by my estimation, the path that, say, Italy and the United States did. Sweden is an interesting case. And I know people often say, well, it's hard to compare Sweden and the United States because, you know, the U.S., 320 million people, racially diverse, ethnically diverse, religiously diverse, and Sweden, you know, ethnically homogenous and, what, 10 million people. But I would make the case that, you know, geographically speaking, Sweden is, a you know, probably about the size, maybe a little bit larger, of almost half of the eastern seaboard, let's say Maine to, I don't know, Pennsylvania or Maryland. And with 10 million people, and they're going a completely different route. I mean, they're doing exactly just what you mentioned, just focus on the demographic that fits the bill as the demographic that is most likely to be hit hard from it. So those that are older than the age of 70, encourage them to stay home and encourage them to wear masks, and you know, don't give orders, you will be fined, and let businesses continue and people not to live in fear. And I think that there's a lot that could be said to that. I think, and I'm going to wrap up, you know, my long-winded soliloquy here, but I think the essence of what I'm trying to say is that in the discovery for science and scientific truth, that there has to be inquiry and investigation and consideration of different approaches. And I'm reminded of Thomas Kuhn and his book on paradigms, you know, that shows that, you know, that there's a real dogmatism when an institution holds very tightly and hardly the position that ours is the way of the truth, and will attack anything that goes outside of that, you know, like the Vatican did with Copernicus. And I can't help but, you know, see a parallel to today in the way that the talk about science is, you know, approached in that manner, as if there are other legitimate scientists who have some opinions about the policies that we're differing opinions about the policies that are currently enacted here in the U.S.
Well, I think there's an elderly gentleman who's going to disagree with you. That's me. and it won't be the first time, would it? So the approach being taken in Sweden is herd immunization, you know, the sort of thing that, you know, our fellow mammals go through. And the sorts of things that over the years during great migrations of sorts that humans have just sort of accidentally practiced. The notion being that the closer we are together, the more we develop the antibodies and then the immunity to certain diseases. The problem with enacting that or allowing that to happen is that we're not dealing with data and statistics. Obviously, we're dealing with real people, and we're exposing people and saying to them, now, some of you are going to be expendable, and some of you are going to survive for the greater good. To the first group, we're sorry. To the second group, congratulations. And I don't know that we can operate like that. So but that's my first observation. The second observation is that by allowing that sort of herd immunization to take place, in a way, not only are we picking winners and losers, but we're taking a risk of being wrong. And those who are in a position of leadership, whether we agree with them or disagree with them, terrible thing to flip a coin and say, hey, let's try this. Even though we may find that it doesn't work. My last problem with that is that, and you alluded to this, obviously, Sweden is different than the United States in terms of density of population and in terms of homogeneity, basically, of their population. And so what if we're wrong? And in choosing a policy like that, the last case where I would respectfully disagree with you is that I really don't see any 1984 world here or any mandate my way or the highway. I mean, the government has to govern and people don't have to blindly obey, but there is a greater responsibility that we have, even as citizens of a free country born into liberty. There are responsibilities that we have to the community as a whole. And to say, well, you know what? You're free to do whatever you want to do as long as you don't hurt anybody. Who's going to decide whether or not you're hurting someone? And so that's my point of departure from your thoughts.
And what we're doing is healthy because we're debating different viewpoints. What I'm troubled by is within a lot of the mainstream media, there is precisely the lack of this kind of healthy debate. And there's really, by my view, more of a one-sided approach as to this is the way it is and this is how it should be. And I just don't believe that is the role of the media. The role of the media it should be to inform the public and to show or to spotlight and highlight what the different information is out there in the marketplace of ideas, but to present the illusion, and I'll say it's the illusion that there really is only one way to do this, and that there's really a strong consensus on what that is entirely false. And look at what YouTube is doing. I mean, there are doctors, epidemiologists, and virologists who didn't just arrive on the scene and graduate from Harvard or whatever the medical school that they went to just a year ago, but doctors who have been researching for 20, 30 years who disagree with the forced policies of wearing masks and the stay-at-home orders and are showing to data and scientific research that this does have the effect of creating, first of all, the reaction that a person is constantly living in a state of fear, which is bad for the immune system, that they're not getting exposure outside to the elements and to the natural world, which is bad for the immune system. And, wearing a mask is just essentially covering yourself and slowly suffocating yourself and breathing in CO2, which is...
Okay. Let me just ask you a question. What is the role of science? What should the role of science be in this?
Now, the role of science is to discover the truth. Always
perfect.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's to discover the truth, because to discover truth is a long process. I mean, Copernicus and Isaac Newton didn't stumble upon their laws because the Catholic Church said, this is how you think. You know, they had to go against the grain, and they had to spend years of research. And then they came upon their scientific laws, which even then, took decades for, people to discover. So, I mean, if we run on the banner of emergency and that you got to go with this. I mean, first of all, on the topic of vaccination, I mean, it's common knowledge that a vaccine needs to be vetted. It needs to be trialed. It's not something that can be developed within months. I mean, we know this going back to the history of since vaccines have been developed, that it's not something you just arrive on the scene and say, all right, well, you folks are the guinea pigs, and let's just give it a try. And then maybe it'll work, and maybe there'll be some adverse effects to it. So, that's what I'm talking about, that. So to answer your question, it's scientific inquiry. It's rigorous investigation. It's controlled studies. And it also allows independent groups to put in their input and test it, and not just one entity. I'll end on one more point. And you alluded to, the notion of, going down the path of 1984. And I'm not suggesting that, but, Alan Dershowitz, who is a Harvard law professor, had some very troubling words the other day. And I have his quote right here, and I'm going to read it word for word. And I'm not going to have any further comment. I'm just going to allow our listeners to think about this. But Dershowitz says, quote, "You have no right not to be vaccinated. You have no right not to wear a mask. You have no right to open up your business. And if you refuse to be vaccinated, the state has the power to literally take you to a doctor's office and plunge a needle into your arm. Essentially, you have no rights."
This is one of the few cases where I find myself agreeing in principle with Alan Dershowitz. Let's move on to less controversy. Let's talk about President Trump and the campaign 2020. How's that?
Sure. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get right to that.
All right.
Welcome back after that fantastic debate. And so here we are moving on into the second segment. And my father, who always has his finger on the pulse of what Americans are thinking regarding the political landscape, has an update about Trump and Biden and some rumors, or maybe even some concrete evidence as to who will emerge as Biden's pick. So why don't you fill in and inform our listeners about all of that, Dad?
Okay, so let's start with the president himself and the anomaly that is Donald Trump and the Donald Trump presidency. So at a point where he is really embattled with the press, really embattled, certainly with Democrats, very embattled even within his own party, we actually see that this week his numbers have gone up. His approval rating is at average at 46%. Remember, that is 46% is the percentage that he received when he won the presidency. The flip side of that, though, is that among those who disapprove, way over half of those who disapprove strongly disapprove. I mean, really, let's just put it bluntly, hate his guts. And so they are motivated. When we take a look at the horse races, two ways of looking at those. On average, Joe Biden leads the president as of this moment. This is Friday morning, the 22nd, leads the president by 5.5 percentage points. Under normal circumstances, that's a healthy lead. Although I caution folks that if you take a look at states like California, New York, Illinois, and so on, the margins in those states for Biden are such that they skew in some ways the national numbers. It's still conceivable that Biden could have a national popular victory of 5 percentage points and yet lose those key, some of those key battleground states and lose the presidency. That has led then to all sorts of speculation. Is Biden up to it? Is Biden losing it? Is Biden leading by enough right now? If the president is so unpopular, why isn't Biden leading by 10? That's where we get into the polls. Today, Quinnipiac has a poll out showing Biden leading nationally by 11. The Hill, who have their polling done by Harris, has Biden leading by 1. So I urge everybody to be good consumers of polls and to take a look, click on the poll itself and take a look at who's actually in the poll and if those demographics you think represent the American electorate. We won't know, of course, until closer to the election. But the anomaly here is that the president maintains his popularity among his base. That was enough to win in 2016. By the same token, there are even more who really distrust and dislike the president. My colleague, Charlie Cook, the Cook Report, has a really excellent observation that he just made yesterday. He took the polling, the exit polling from 2016, and took a look at those who disliked and distrusted Hillary Clinton, disliked, distrusted Donald Trump. And what he discovered is that that group alone voted for Donald Trump by a considerable number of percentage points. This time around, he took the substantial number of people who say, on average, in many of the polls, they dislike and distrust Joe Biden, dislike, distrust Donald Trump. And what he discovered is that they, as of today anyway, are supporting Joe Biden over Donald Trump, 49-18. So that's a very important internal number. And that's kind of where we stand today. It's going to be very interesting. I alluded to the fact that Americans have made a lot of adjustments in our lives. We're going to see a major adjustment coming up shortly as the campaign begins in earnest. And Joe Biden, at least, will decide to take the Democratic approach, and that is to not hold rallies and to social distance, at least for a while anyway. What do you think?
Well, I think that was a pretty well summed up analysis of what's going on. And here we are in May 22nd today, and we still have several months. And something mm-hmm. tells me that there's going to be a lot of push-pull. There's going to be a lot of dance moves going back and forth. And so I look forward to seeing through the summer, and especially when we get into the critical month of October, where the nation will stand. I would think, and you tell me whether you agree or not, but it looks that it's still up in the air.
I think it is. And here's something that's being hotly debated right now. The president has decided to go after, vigorously go after Barack Obama, to the point where he's charging Obama with conspiracies regarding Michael Flynn, charging Obama with corruption that the press never investigated, or the criminal justice agencies never investigated. Really not a shred of evidence on any of these things. However, what is the advisability of going after Barack Obama in pretty much every instance, probably the most popular political figure in the United States today? Do you think this is a wise strategy on his part?
I mean, it's very Trumpist, right? It certainly fits his personality. And at the end of the day, what does Trump try to do? He tries to rally his base. He's really good at it. He can't bring out the rallies anymore because of the situation that we're in. And I mean, really, and I don't think that this is necessarily special to Trump and his base, who I think we agree are basically just a rebounded version of the Tea Party, right? Where did the Ron Paul revolution go after 2012? Where did the Tea Party go after 2012? Well, they just put red hats on. I would argue probably at least 90% of them. So, you know, they do see Obama as the devil incarnate, right? They do. I mean, they would tell you that that was what basically motivated them to the Tea Party resistance was, you know, that all of this that started after the bailouts back in 2008 and 2009. And so I think it's probably, from Trump's point of view, the best way to rally his base behind him and ensure that he doesn't lose, you know, 3, 4, or 5% that really could be the difference in the election.
So real quickly, only because we mentioned that we'd get into it really quickly, the vice presidential buzz these days are around three women. Kamala Harris is one. Elizabeth Warren is the other. Amy Klobuchar is the third. That's interesting. If I were to choose, I would be looking among those three at Amy Klobuchar. Even though politically she's a clone of Joe Biden, she doesn't bring in any progressive credentials. She still is a person who could help deliver a state. I'm still not buying the Kamala Harris. I think there's too much friction there. And I think with Elizabeth Warren, among the other factors, I've mentioned a number of them, but I don't think that Massachusetts wants to give up a Democratic Senate seat. If Warren were to be elected vice president, then the Republican governor, Charlie Baker, would be in a position to appoint someone until another election could be held. He would choose a Republican right at a time when the Democrats are trying to squeak through and get a majority.
So I guess I would ask, who out of those three is the candidate that can deliver a state like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio? I mean, it would seem like Klobuchar. It would seem like you wouldn't want a progressive firebrand like Warren or Kamala Harris that could actually upset and lead to victories towards Trump and Pence. What do you think about that?
I think it is Klobuchar. I'm still partial to Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, especially too, since she's been a lightning rod, Donald Trump attacking her. A name that is moving up the line slowly is Val Demings, African-American woman who was, interestingly, the chief of police in the city of Orlando, congresswoman. A lot of push for an African-American woman. This is an African-American woman, unlike, say, Stacey Abrams, who's actually run a big city to police department and has been in Congress on the federal level. But if it's among the three that I mentioned, I think my bet would go with Klobuchar. I do know that she's being vetted over this weekend, maybe right now as we're speaking.
Well, that about does it for me, unless you have anything else on your mind.
Well, next week, let's promise people we're going to talk about what we're going to ask in this poll that we're doing. And I'll just leave by saying that other pollsters, I think, have been doing a good job interpreting polling on where we stand and what we believe and how we are acting today. We're going to do what we've become famous for, projective questions. How will we be in the future? And how do you anticipate your behavior having changed into the future? And I look forward to sharing that with everybody. And I'm going to say goodbye and have a nice Memorial weekend.
Take care. Have a great Memorial weekend.
Great.